Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Okay, you or your son or daughter have gone to college, earned a degree, so now what? How do you connect the dots between what your education has prepared you for and a real job and career? Well, there's a tool for that now. Kentucky Secretary of Education and Workforce Development Derek Ramsey is here to tell us all about it. And we thank you for joining us, Secretary Ramsey.
Thank you, Tom, very much for having me.
Earlier in the year, the Kentucky Center for Statistics, which is within the Education and Workforce Development Cabinet, launched a free online Career Explorer tool. Mm-hmm. First of all, what was the problem this tool was intended to resolve?
Well, so frequently when you travel around, or when I travel around and I talk to the businesses, one of the things I was hearing on a frequent basis was that it's taken me a year to a year and a half before I get a return on my investment. And so one of the things that we're looking at doing now is that with this tool, it will allow you to be tested out and tease out what your interests are.
So who is it intended for?
It's for everyone. Mm-hmm. It is for everyone, for college students, for kids that are preparing to go to college. With this tool, it will also tell you, for example, if you want to major in communications, well, that's really not what you're interested in. And this tool can tease all that out to help you find what it is that you're really interested in.
So it helps you gain a focus.
Absolutely. Well, not only focus, but become more knowledgeable about what it is that you think. I'll use myself, for example. Well, when I graduated from UK, I got my degree in communications, but my real interest to this day is economics.
Oh,
and
okay.
So I wish there was something at that time that would have teased this out, you know, because I think every athlete wants to be a broadcaster. So hence, that's why I went that direction. But my real interest is economy and being an economist.
Isn't that interesting? I wonder how many people, whatever it is that they're doing, athletics in your case, but really there's something that else that they would really rather be doing with their life.
Well, the interesting part about that also is that over 80% of the people that get a degree in one thing are working in another field. And so for those that always, when I talk to young people, the thing that they're always talking about is, I want to do something I enjoy. Well, I've enjoyed a lot of the jobs I had, but are they my number one interest? Not really. But it's something I did, and I came pretty good at it. But if I had this kind of tool at an early age in particular, there's no telling where I would be. There's no telling where the economy would be either.
Yeah, we never know that.
Right.
If a listener wants to check it out, they want to go online to kystats.ky.gov and then /Career Explorer.
Right.
If they do that, what are they going to find?
Just the access to be able to get information. Who do I contact? What do I contact? The basics of what this is about. Because, again, it's a new tool, and I think an invaluable tool that our young folk, but not necessarily only young people, but people in general can use this. Because so much time is wasted when you're trying things out versus if you have an idea this is something that you really want to do.
I also wanted to talk to you about the Cabinet's Modern Apprenticeship Program.
Mm-hmm.
First, what exactly is an apprenticeship?
Well, apprenticeship. I'm going to take you down memory lane, if you would. When I was coming out of high school in 1974, there were two on-ramps to success, if you would. One on-ramp was college prep. The other on-ramp was vocational. Well, what's happened over the last 40 years? The vocational schools have been stigmatized out, closed out, or just flat shut down. And so what has happened over this 40-year period, we have neglected our infrastructure, our bridges, our roads, all of these things, airports. And so with that in mind, today, the average journey person in the U.S. is 58 years of age. And we have very few in that pipeline. For example, We have 340 million people here in the U.S., and we only have 550,000 journeymen. That is not enough. And so the average journey person will make, which young people are always interested in, the average journey person in our country makes $60,000. And the part that I really love about it is that when they get this or become a journeyman or journeywoman, in most cases, there's no debt.
Who is a typical candidate for an apprenticeship?
Any and everyone. There are no age limits. When I first took this job as labor secretary 3.5 years ago, I went to one of my first graduations. A young man was 45 years of age. Also, there were a number of young people there that were in that 23 to 25 range as well. So for those that are interested, but let me also say as well, Tom, when you think about apprentice people, in most cases, they always think of the construction, the old apprentice. Mm-hmm. Well, there's over 1,000 apprenticeable ideas and concepts on the books. For example, you can have a person come and shadow you and be one of your apprentices. We have them in IT. We have them in healthcare. We have them in nursing. We have them in banking. We have them in insurance. So it's not just those limited areas that they used to be in.
It sounds like Kentucky businesses are really getting with the program.
Absolutely. We have over 200, almost 275 businesses now that have signed up with us that are doing different type of apprentices. Because, again, the message early on, when we started down this journey 3.5 years ago, everybody thought it was just construction, the old staples, HVAC, plumbing, electrician, welding. No, there are all these things and more. If you go back many, many years ago, an attorney, they were an apprentice before they became an attorney. So this is something that's been in our country for 90 years now, and we're just having to go back to it because we have so few people. Again, as I travel around the state, every place I've been asked, Secretary, can you assist me in finding a HVAC guy? Can you help me find an electrician? Can you help me find a plumber? These folk are in dire need.
So let me make sure I understand. This means on-the-job training.
Yes.
There's also a classroom component, right?
Yes, there is. To become a journey person, depending on the discipline.
And that's with a certification?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. You could take as little as 2,000 hours of OJT, but for our main ones that get you, let's say, a electrician, and you're going to be a commercial electrician, you have 564 hours of class time, and you'll have 6,000 hours of OJT. And so it's that combination of both. And so if you're going to be a electrician for a home, instead of taking 6,000 hours, it requires about 2,000 to 3,000 hours. And so with that in mind, you figure out what it is that you want to do. And then we figure out how to put it together. But the part also that I love about this, from day one, as an apprentice, you're compensated. And these are not low-wage jobs. On average, our apprentice started about $11.25 an hour, and that's across the board in the state, regardless of the discipline. And so, again, when these folk, young folk in particular, when they have an opportunity to earn and learn, it just makes the process a lot better.
If a business registers to house an apprenticeship, does this add a layer of oversight or administrative responsibility for the employer?
No, it just what it does is once they become a registered. Let me back up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I met a gentleman about a year ago, and I was at the Chamber of Commerce speaking in Paducah. And I was talking about The Apprentice and how I love it and why I think it's good. Because, again, I think the apprentice model will change the trajectory of earning in the Commonwealth for a generation, if not two. I firmly believe that. Second, this gentleman in our conversation, he was saying, Secretary, I'm so glad you're here and just wanted to share with you. I, too, have embraced the apprenticeship model. I have some apprentices that have been with me for 10 years. I said, whoa, whoa, we don't have a 10-year program. I said, what you have is you have cheap labor. Because normally what you have in the migration is this. First year, $11.25. Year two, they're at about $12.50. Year three, $13.50, maybe $13.75. Year four, when they're finished, they go off and become a journeyman or journeywoman. That number could be $30 an hour. It could be $28 an hour. But for 10 years, where you have a person that's 12, no, that's not an apprentice. That's called cheap labor. And he says, oh, I'm sorry. I said, it's okay. I'm going to have someone contact you, and we're going to get you to become a registered apprentice, and then we'll get this thing going.
And these employers cover any tuition that's involved, right?
Well, the tuition, they'll cover the schooling, yes. But so much of that is OJT and class time. And so, you know, it gives a person an opportunity because let's as we look at these young people or people in general, they have to have some income. And so, again, from day one, they get that opportunity. And in most cases, as you mentioned, the employer will pay for any schooling as well as tools.
So I wonder, what do you see out there? How have you seen this change lives?
I've seen it change lives tremendously because in some places where there's very little work, to be able to equip someone with a skill that not only is the skill set valuable in this state and accepted in this state, but once you have mine, the governor's signature, that certificate is good in all the other 49 states as well as Canada and Australia. And so with that, it's changing lives. And again, when I stated the average journeyman makes $60,000, the average, the median income in the state of Kentucky for a family of four is less than $45,000. So with that in mind, that's why I think, and key word, and I want to underline this, average. Well, there's no one average here in the state of Kentucky. None of us average. And so with that in mind, if you want to work for a business and make that $60,000 or more, or you're equipped and knowledgeable enough to start your own business. So I think the sky's the limit. For example, there was a young man that graduated from Franklin County High School about 3 years ago now. 1 year removed from Franklin County High School as a welder, he made $148,000.
Kentucky Secretary of Education and Workforce Development Derek Ramsey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me so much time.
Sunday morning ever, and Sundays pass on by. I'll be working here forever, at least until I die. Damn if you do, damn if you don't. I'm supposed to get a raise next week, you know that when I won't.
Coming up after the break.
Today, it's actually the highest in the nation. Almost one in five 50 to 59-year-olds in Kentucky are estimated to be food insecure.
James Ziliak, director of the Center for Poverty Research at UK, here with Tamara Sandberg of the nonprofit Feeding Kentucky.
You often would be very surprised to find who is struggling with hunger. Most Americans, we couldn't even handle a $400 emergency. So many of us are one car accident away or one hospital visit away, one layoff away from needing help from a food bank as well.
Later in the hour, Broadway Buddies brings kids from all around Central Kentucky to experience live musicals at the Lexington Opera House, and now it's expanding by a factor of five. Plus, great outdoors guru Chris Begley with tips on building a pleasant and safe campfire. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
We've been poring over a study that documents the state of hunger among senior Americans. It's quite detailed and is based on data from the Census Bureau's most recently available current population survey. And this is part of a series of reports on food insecurity among seniors produced annually since 2012 by Dr. James Ziliak, Gatton Endowed Chair of Microeconomics, Director of the Center for Poverty Research, and Executive Director of the Kentucky Research Data Center at the University of Kentucky. The most recent report is co-authored by Professor Craig Gunderson of the University of Illinois. Dr. Ziliak is here, and we thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And as I mentioned, the annual report is quite detailed, and if you want to dig into those details, you can go to the Facts and Information tab on our site, esweku.com. It's there for reading and downloading. And we've invited Dr. Ziliak to give us some key snapshots from that report. So first I'd like to begin, if you would, define for us what is meant by food insecure.
In the United States, food insecurity is the inability to provide enough food for yourself or members of your household due to economic reasons. And so we strive hard to make sure we're identifying kind of an economic risk of inability to provide food as opposed to some other factor, perhaps dieting or other reasons why you might abstain from food, maybe some other health condition that's not really economic based. It's measured each year through a survey conducted by the U.S. Census Bureau on behalf of the U.S. Department of Agriculture in December of each year. And it's a survey of 50 to 60,000 households selected randomly across the United States. So it's nationally representative. It's also representative at the state level as well. And individuals are asked a series of 18 questions in this supplement to the monthly survey. And the questions range from, did you worry whether or not you're going to run out of money to provide enough food due to economic reasons, or to the point where, did you skip food for a whole day? Did children in the household skip food for a whole day due to economic reasons? So there's a series of unfolding questions that are asked. And to be classified as food insecure, you have to answer yes to at least three of the 18 questions on the survey.
And so from this data, you're able to compile a statistical portrait, a snapshot of what we're talking about in the area of food insecurity.
That's right. What's nice about this data set, it's very rich on a bunch of socioeconomic characteristics, income, education, attainment, race, marital status, really take a deep portrait of who's at risk of food insecurity in the United States.
Now, you've been tracking trends in food insecurity that go back to 2001, and that period has included the Great Recession. How do today's food insecurity rates compare?
For seniors in the United States, food insecurity rates are not much lower than what they were at the peak of the Great Recession around 2008, 2009. This is different than the population overall. Population overall, food insecurity rates are close to where they were at the pre-recession level. And I might add, for kind of across the spectrum of the population, the risk of food insecurity increased about 30% from 2007 to 2008. And it's been a lot more stable amongst seniors. It's fallen a little bit since the absolute peak in 2014, but it's still well above the pre-recession level.
And why has it persisted?
Well, we think there are several reasons. One, there's a number of costs that seniors face that have increased at a much higher rate than the rate of inflation overall. In particular, out-of-pocket medical costs are a substantial risk that seniors face So they face this trade-off between providing medicine to attain to medical conditions as opposed to providing food for themselves. We think that's certainly one factor. Another factor is interest rates have been very low for the last several years. So if you're a saver and have relatively conservative investments, when many people in retirement do, they haven't been earning much in terms of interest income. It's also the case that because inflation's been low, the annual cost of living adjustment for Social Security has actually been quite low as well for many years running. And so all of these kind of add up to seniors. I think some aspects of their financial lives have become much more expensive, and therefore the risk of food insecurity has kind of been sustained.
It's not surprising to see that seniors below the poverty line are far more likely to be experiencing food insecurity than those well above the poverty line. But what other socioeconomic disparities do you see in these numbers?
Well, before I mention some of those, I do actually want to highlight it is the case that income is one of the strongest determinants. And so if you're a senior with income below the poverty line, you're at considerable greater risk of food insecurity than somebody above the poverty line. That said, there are more seniors whose annual income is above two times the poverty line. So for a single individual, two times the poverty line would be about $24,000. So if your annual income is over $24,000, there are actually more seniors in America food insecure with incomes over twice the poverty line than there are living in poverty. So that suggests as though there are other factors besides income that determine that risk of food insecurity. And one of those factors is disability. That's a very strong risk factor. And so if you lack mobility to either take care of some basic activities of daily living, that can increase your risk of food insecurity. If you have a lack of ability, including, you know, cooking, preparing food. Other factors are being a recent widower, a divorce. So those are lead to increased risk of food insecurity. Minority seniors are at greater risk of food insecurity. So African Americans versus whites, they have risk about twice as high. Hispanics are at least 50% greater risk of food insecurity than non-Hispanics. People who are renters as opposed to homeowners are at greater risk. People who live in rural areas are at greater risk. And what's really one of the fascinating findings of this work is that older seniors are actually at less risk than younger seniors. And in fact, the group that's at greatest risk are those between the ages of 60 and 64. And this is that, you know, until the Affordable Care Act in 2014, that was kind of that donut hole of people who are on the cusp of retirement and yet don't qualify for Medicare, which doesn't become available until age 65. And so mm-hmm. this is a group who are oftentimes transitioning from maybe employer-provided health care to potentially no health care until age 65. And so that group is actually at heightened risk compared to older seniors.
It's really interesting. The more we peel away the layers of the onion, it becomes more complicated, doesn't
yeah.
it? So microeconomics is your realm, I take it. And so if we could, let's zoom in and take a look at state-level food insecurity rates as they pertain to Kentucky. What do the numbers tell you?
So Kentucky has consistently has slightly below average food insecurity rates for some of the measures that we look at. We look at three different measures. The main one, food insecurity. Kentucky, some years they have above average, some years it's slightly below. But it, you know, overall as a state, we don't really stick out as being, that much different than kind of the quote-unquote average state, which is, you know, to some extent, perhaps surprising because, you know, the Commonwealth on average incomes are lower. And so that suggests as though there might be some other programs going on in the Commonwealth that are taking care of our seniors compared to some of the other states in the South. You know, if you look at the states with the 10 states with the greatest risk of food insecurity, in a typical year since we've been doing this research, 7 or 8 out of the 10 of those states are in the South. And so Kentucky is actually typically not in that top 10 risk set of food insecurity.
You've been following these statistics for many years now, and I'm wondering what trends or changes stand out in your mind.
So there's a couple of things. One, this year we did a supplemental report on food insecurity amongst 50 to 59-year-olds. An interesting aspect of this group, right? This is the group that's leading up the decade prior to retirement. And so if you look at Kentucky, there's been a strong increase since 2001 in the fraction of 50 to 59-year-olds who are food insecure. And today, it's actually the highest in the nation. Almost one in five 50 to 59-year-olds in Kentucky are estimated to be food insecure. And that's a very high rate, considerably higher than the national average. And so that, to me, is portends a worry going forward that this group, if it persists, you know, in this risk of food insecurity going into retirement years, that Kentucky might be actually looking towards a greater surge of food insecurity going forward. As seniors overall, from 2001, there's been a large increase nationally, both in the rate as well as the number. Of course, we have an aging population in the United States. And so, you know, even if the percentage remained the same, there would be more people because there are more older people than there was in 2001. But we're most worried that, you know, the risk of food insecurity is about 50% higher overall today than it was 17 years ago. And so that, I think, should be viewed as a serious challenge to policymakers in the Commonwealth as well as nationally to address this issue of food insecurity.
As an economist, you watch these trends, and with the most recent data on senior food insecurity due to be published later on this year, are you anticipating further evidence of additional change in the nutritional well-being of seniors, building on what you just told us?
Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to see much improvement for seniors. This population has been kind of stable in terms of their rates of food insecurity after the Great Recession, more so than younger Americans. And I don't think there's anything that's happened last year to affect seniors' economic situation. The stock market, as you know, has been quite volatile. So there's been nothing dramatic to affect the economic lives of seniors over the last 12 months. And so I think this trend is going to, unfortunately, stick with us.
UK Microeconomics Chair Dr. James Ziliak, Director of the Center for Poverty Research and Executive Director of the Kentucky Research Data Center at the University of Kentucky. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, the annual report is quite detailed, and if you want to dig into those stats and details, you can go to the Facts and Information tab on our website, esweku.com. It's there for reading and downloading. James Ziliak provided us with a statistical portrait of hunger among senior Kentuckians. Now let's turn to the human experience and some misconceptions, even myths, going around about hunger in Kentucky in general and not just limited to senior citizens. For that, we've invited into the studio Tamara Sandberg, Executive Director of Feeding Kentucky. Greetings, Tamara.
Thank you for having me.
And first of all, tell us about your organization, Feeding Kentucky. What do you do?
So Feeding Kentucky is the statewide association of the seven regional Feeding America food banks that serve all 120 counties in Kentucky in partnership with 800 local food pantries. So last year, our members distributed 64 million meals all throughout the Commonwealth.
So to pick up on Dr. Ziliak's comments, what are you seeing in the way of food insecurity among Kentucky seniors?
You know, it is unfortunate that Kentucky is on the top of too many lists that we don't want to be. We weren't at all surprised to find, thanks to Dr. Ziliak's research, that Kentucky has the highest rate in the nation of the food insecurity among adults 50 to 53. We see it all the time in the food pantries in our network. People who have been hurt at work but are having a hard time qualifying for disabilities. People in that age who may be caring for grandchildren that put a strain on their household finances. There's quite a lot of people in that age bracket that are suffering. And also, of course, 60 and above, we're also higher than the national average for that.
I mentioned that we would expand beyond seniors for this conversation. What can you tell us about what it looks like on the other end of the age spectrum among children?
Yeah, it is just unacceptable that so many children in Kentucky and the rest of the nation are facing food insecurity, which is the official definition of hunger, struggling with hunger. Kentucky has a higher rate than the national average of children. We know that nearly one in five kids in Kentucky live in a household where somebody is going without food or stretching the food to make it go farther. And we know that school is harder for kids who are hungry, as our kids are getting ready to go back to school, or many of them are already in. We know that if those kids didn't eat breakfast because there wasn't food in the household, they're going to have a harder time concentrating in school. It has long-term impacts on their health, their educational attainment. So childhood food insecurity is a serious problem in Kentucky.
The Department of Agriculture, the USDA, does a community population survey, and it yields a lot of information about food security or insecurity. What does it tell us about Kentucky?
So we know we can drill it down by county. We know that there's over 185,000 children in Kentucky who live in a household without enough food. And we know that it ranges from a low in Oldham County to a high in Magoffin County of just about 24%. So we're able to tell anybody that's interested in knowing what's going on in their community, we can tell them exactly how many children and what the rate is who are facing hunger in Kentucky.
This might be a little clinical for something that's so human, but how is hunger measured?
So that's an excellent question. Hunger is measured using the USDA's definition of food insecurity, and that's jargon that we try not to use too much because, you know, hunger is a feeling that can be different for everyone, but food insecurity is the actual measure of the conditions that lead to hunger. So the official USDA definition is food insecurity describes a household's inability to provide enough food for every person to live a healthy, active lifestyle. So it could be like a grandparent who skips a meal to make sure her grandchildren have enough to eat. It could be, you know, watering down your milk to make it stretch farther. We, thankfully, in America, we don't see, you know, starvation. We don't see children, unless there's been instances of abuse and neglect, with distended bellies starving. But we do have a lot of children who are not receiving the amount of nutrition they need. And in a country that produces the most food in the world, that's just simply unacceptable.
Oh, and this goes to some of those misconceptions that people have, doesn't it? I mean, there's the view that there's a hunger crisis in other parts of the world, but not in America, not in Kentucky. Why do we think that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it goes to the shame factor of hunger. I think as a country, we should be ashamed that anybody in our, you know, abundantly rich country is going without food. And it also goes to the shame of the people themselves who are facing hunger. It's a hidden problem. People hide it. You often would be very surprised to find who is struggling with hunger. It's in every community in Kentucky has somebody struggling with hunger. So it could be your neighbor. It could be your child's classmate. It could be the senior citizen in line in front of you. But we don't talk about it. You know, that if you survive breast cancer, you wear a pink ribbon and you march in parades, and there's a lot of pride about that. If you survive a trial with food insecurity, as one in six Kentuckians are facing, we don't feel that same source of pride about it. So it's a hidden problem.
Kind of a stigma attached to it, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
I'd like to bring up a couple of more myths or misconceptions that you've told me about and ask you to respond to each. And the first is that people who face hunger in Kentucky are typically homeless or unemployed.
Right. That's exactly the stereotype that we often hear. That's why people think they are amazed when we tell them what the actual rate of food insecurity is. But in fact, 96% of the households served by our food bank network, they live in non-temporary housing, like a house or apartment. 96%. So these are people who are not living under a bridge in the middle. No, it's your neighbor. It's your child's classmate. So homelessness is a problem, but it's the stereotype that you must be homeless to be suffering from hunger in Kentucky is just absolutely not true.
And then there's the perception that hunger is limited to urban or to very rural areas.
Exactly. Yes. We have a map on our website that shows every single county in Kentucky has somebody struggling with hunger. From, like I said, the low is Oldham County, but every single county has somebody struggling. Jefferson
County.
What's
the worst?
The worst is Magoffin County, unfortunately, at about 22% overall. They have both the highest rate for overall and the highest rate for child food insecurity. And You know, it is true that 26 of the 30 counties in Kentucky with the highest rates of food insecurity are in Appalachia. But every county in Kentucky has this problem. So it's not just urban. It's not just Appalachian. It's a Kentucky problem.
Any other of these myths or misperceptions that kind of drive you crazy?
You know, it's really hard to hear people talk about I haven't heard it articulated exactly this way, but this concept of the undeserving poor, that if you're struggling with hunger in Kentucky, it's because you're lazy. And I would challenge anybody who thinks that to come with me to a food pantry or food bank, and you will see people standing in line wearing their fast food service uniform, wearing their retail uniform. They came straight from work. They are working really hard, some of them multiple jobs, but they are not being paid enough to keep food on the table, or they have inconsistent hours, and when they have a sick child, they have no paid leave, so they stay home with their child and get fired. People who struggle with hunger in Kentucky, it is not because they are lazy. It's not because they're undeserving. It's because they have difficult circumstances that, frankly, most Americans may find themselves facing one day. There was that recent study that showed that most Americans, we couldn't even handle a $400 emergency. So many of us are one car accident away or one hospital visit away, one layoff away from needing help from a food bank as well.
How sadly ironic it is that food workers, food service workers, are finding themselves in the line at a food bank.
Absolutely. So sad.
So you are asking Kentuckians to take action to end hunger. What can we do?
You know, volunteering at your local food pantry or food bank is a great way to help. In fact, more than half of the food pantries in our network are run completely by volunteers. You can contact us at our website, feedingky.org, and we'll get you connected. Food donations are always very welcome. People have had great success hosting food drives. But I'll tell you one thing, if you want to make the deepest impact on hunger in Kentucky, it's not going to the store and buying a 99 cents of canned goods. It's donating that 99 cents or a dollar to your food pantry or food bank. Our network, because of our purchasing power, we can turn over that dollar about 12 times more than if you just gave us a can of food. People like to donate food, and we are always happy to accept it. But really, the deepest impact is if you just donate a dollar and save yourself the trip to the grocery store.
That's really interesting. I'm sure a lot of people didn't realize that.
Yeah, yeah.
Tamara Sandberg, Executive Director of Feeding Kentucky, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Coming up after the break,
art changes our lives.
Lexington Opera House Performing Arts Director Lou Anne Franklin.
It really does have an impact on our culture, and we want people to understand that, and that live theatrical experience is just unmatchable.
She's here to tell us about a program that provides that experience to hundreds of school children in Central Kentucky. Plus, great outdoors guru Chris Begley is back.
If I was going to give one bit of advice to anybody outdoors, it's carry a lighter.
Planning a late summer or fall camping trip? Chris has some campfire pointers. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
If I were a rich man, all day long I'd biddy biddy bum. If I were a wealthy man, wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a bitty bitty rich digger digger deedle diddle man.
Broadway has buddies in Kentucky, and here to tell us all about that and other happenings at the Lexington Opera House is Lexington Center Director of Performing Arts, Luann Franklin. Thanks for coming in, Luann.
So glad to be here, Tom. Thanks.
So, Luann, make sense of what I just said. What is or who are Broadway buddies?
Broadway Buddies is an outreach program that we began almost 10 years ago now. And it was an effort to allow educators or other groups who might not have the opportunity to attend a professional Broadway show that opportunity. But we wanted it to be more than just tickets to the show. So we've expanded that to include a class that the students are required to come to prior to attending the show.
Do they come to that class at the Opera House, or is this happening in their schools?
No, they come to the Opera House. It's really, really exciting and growing. But they will, this year, for the first time, come during the school day. Uh-huh. And for about a 90-minute class at the theater, they'll get a tour of the Opera House. They'll learn about the history. They'll go on stage and backstage and get to see some of the technical elements there. And then we talk about theater etiquette with them, as well as prepare them for the production that they're going to see.
So as you said, you've been doing this for quite a while. Do you see sparks in the eyes of these kids when you take them backstage and they see all that technology and how things work?
It's so interesting because some of them have immediate questions and others just are like little sponges and they take it in. What we see and what is so gratifying is that over the course of time, from the class to the day they come to see the show, the excitement builds, and then they have even more questions. And whenever there's an opportunity, we also provide them with a quick meet and greet with some of the cast members after the show.
You mentioned that you've expanded. I know it's been 100 kids up till this year. How many can you now accommodate?
Well, thanks to some wonderful support from the Opera House Fund, we are able to designate a performance for our buddies. It's going to be a Thursday evening performance in February. The title is Fiddler on the Roof this year. And we were able to offer an additional performance thanks to this support. And while the public will be invited as well to purchase tickets, we have seats for about 500 students this year, along with their chaperones.
So this has grown by a factor of five.
Yes.
Invitations to participate have now gone out beyond Fayette County.
That's right.
Is the outreach limited to the region surrounding Fayette County or beyond that?
Well, our efforts prior to this year, prior to this growth, were pretty much included only in the immediate area because of transportation partially and because of the limited number of seats that we had to offer. But with this growth, we have, of course, reached out to Fayette County, but we've also identified educators in high school for this performance this year, high school in arts, in history, in theater, in music. And we have done some research and gotten those email addresses, and those are going out to those teachers in high schools in the contiguous counties around Fayette County. But it's not limited to just those counties. If someone hears about the program and would like more information, they can go to our website, which is lexingtonoperahouse.com. Scroll down, you'll see Broadway Buddies information.
What goes on the school end of this to determine who gets to come or who wants to come?
Well, this year, it's pretty much a first-come, first-serve opportunity. We do have an application process, so the teacher does have to, you know, check her schedule, make sure that she can come to both the school day class as well as the performance, which is on a Thursday evening. So there's some coordination there for the teacher or the sponsor. And then once they make application, we will get back to them with how many tickets we can accommodate. We ask that our applicants limit their request to somewhere between 20 and 30 tickets. But if it's more than that, don't hesitate to ask, because if we have them, we sure want to award them.
You spoke a moment ago about the effect that this has on these kids. What do you envision as a long-term outcome from this experience? Is this the kind of thing that you think that they might carry with them through life?
It's interesting, yes. That's what we hope for. Of course, we're going to talk about career opportunities in the arts industry and the entertainment industry while they're there. So they'll learn about that. They'll learn about theater craft, so that might spark an interest. Then, of course, with a Broadway musical, there is the music, the art, the lighting, so many things. And it's been so gratifying again and rewarding to see these kids come back. And I had one young lady who came to our very first Broadway Buddies program many years ago, returned to the Opera House last year and said, I was in your first Broadway Buddies class. I've never forgotten it. I can't wait to introduce my daughter to theater this year. And that's what we hope, because, you know, arts changes our lives, whether it's music or theater or dance or all of those things. It really does have an impact on our culture, and we want people to understand that. And that live theatrical experience is just unmatchable.
And so this is a great way to grow that audience.
Absolutely.
For the future. Before I let you go, I have to ask you about something else, and it's that marquee that's going up on the outside of the Opera House, I think on the Broadway side, is that correct?
Yes. The original entrance to the historic Lexington Opera House was on Broadway when it was renovated in the 70s. A major entrance was added on Short Street, but that original entrance on Broadway has sort of faded into the facade of the street. And so we've always wanted to be able to bring that back to life. And again, thanks to some wonderful funding through the Opera House Fund, we are able to do that. We've had a beautifully designed marquee in fabrication right now, and that will light up Broadway sometime this fall.
If anybody wants to know more about how to attend events at the Opera House, where can they find the information? And also, if you want to provide ticket information.
Sure. Broadway Live tickets, season tickets are still available by contacting our box office. It is the Rupp Arena box office, Lexington Center ticket office. That number is 859-233-3535. Or go online or Ticketmaster. And I should mention that while our season tickets are still on sale, tickets to individual shows, as well as our Variety Live shows, go on sale to the public on September 9th.
Lou Ann Franklin, she's Director of Performing Arts at the Lexington Center Corporation. Thank you so much, Lou Ann.
Thanks, Tom.
Archaeologist Chris Begley is back with more advice to help you safely and thoughtfully enjoy getting out of the house and into the woods. Welcome back, Chris.
Thank you, Tom.
So tell us what we need to know to build, start, and then maintain a really good campfire.
Well, a campfire in either just a recreational situation or certainly in any survival situation is going to be really important. It's important to understand that it consists really of three elements: air, fuel, and heat that you need. The heat's not so much the ambient temperature, but what keeps the combustion going. So for our purposes as somebody that's making a campfire, really the most important thing is to prepare your area, have the right materials, and have some source of combustion. If I was going to give one bit of advice to anybody outdoors, it's carry a lighter. A little disposable lighter. That just makes starting a fire so much easier.
It's a lot easier than rubbing a couple of sticks together, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, rubbing sticks together does work, but it's really not going to be what you want to rely on. There's any number of other ways it would be better.
We're talking about fire here, and fire can be wonderful. It can be warming. It can be mesmerizing to sit and watch, to smell the burning wood, to watch the sparks lifting up off the fire. It can also be extremely rapidly dangerous. What are some safety tips that you could give us?
Well, I think the most important thing is to prepare your area so that there isn't combustible material around your fire. You certainly don't want it spreading in the middle of the night when you're asleep or after you leave, especially in dry months, can really pose a risk here. So clearing off the area, make a fire ring with rocks, make sure there aren't combustible materials. And then the other important thing is going to be to really douse the fire when you're done. And there are many ways to do that, but the easiest way is to put water on it. And whatever you do, putting water on it, spreading it out, stamping it out, it should be cool by the time you leave to really be sure that it's not going to reignite.
And what if you don't have water?
Well, then it's going to take a little bit longer. Of course, thinking back on those three elements that you need, if you can remove the fuel, if you can isolate what's burning, it's just not going to last very long by itself. Or if you can remove the air, if you can cover it with sand, cover it with dirt, suffocate it is another way. But if you don't have any water to put on it, which is going to be unlikely here in Kentucky with so many waterways, it's just going to take longer to be sure that it is, in fact, out.
Okay, we talked about carrying a lighter, about the difficulty in starting a fire by rubbing a couple of sticks together. But what if you've taken a day hike and you really intended to go back home that evening, so you didn't come prepared, you didn't bring a lighter, you don't have really anything that you need. You were just going for a walk in the woods, you got lost somehow, and there you are. It's dark, and you sure could use a good warm fire. Is there anything that you can do?
If you really have no combustion source, it's going to be really difficult. If you have something that can make a spark, or if you can find something, flint and steel, you might be able to light something on fire. Now, typically, if you were doing something like hiking, it wouldn't really be much of an effort to put in your pack something that easily lights on fire with a spark and something that can create a spark. There are all of these fire starter rods that you can buy. Those work really well. And in terms of something to light, in my experience, there's almost nothing easier than cotton balls to light on fire. Just a spark hits them and there they are. And that will allow you to light then the kindling, slightly larger stuff, and then ultimately the fuel that you'll put on your fire once it's going.
I guess really the ultimate moral of the story is to not take that day hike unprepared.
If you're completely unprepared, it'd be really, really difficult to start a fire. Now, starting it by some friction method, rubbing the sticks together, it's possible. Unfortunately, it's easiest in the types of weather that you least need a fire, when it's dry, when it's warm, and it's really going to be hard when it's rainy and 35 degrees.
Any further thoughts on building a good campfire?
Yeah, the other thing is if you're going to build it, you need to do some preparation before you get underway. And one thing that you certainly want to do is make sure that you have enough fuel stockpiled nearby so that when you do get it going, you have something to put on there. Fires go through more fuel than you'll imagine and than you expect. Still, for me, I'm always caught unaware or surprised at how much fuel you go through. So stockpile that nearby before you start your fire. You don't want to get a small fire going and then have it go out while you're scrounging for more material.
Archaeologist Chris Begley joins us from time to time with tips for safely enjoying the great outdoors. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app, on esweku.com, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.